Now, growing up in the Killarney of the 50s and the side of Lower New Street, only three things dominated our young lives. Gaelic football, basketball, and following Manchester United. Or should I say, following the Busby Babes. Basketball had just begun in Kerry. Castlevine won the first senior county title ever played for. And in 1957, a group of young men came together in Killarney and formed the Busby Babes basketball team. They would go on and win town leagues, championships, minor, junior and senior county championships, and one memorable Munster title, all in a set of jerseys presented to them by the United manager, Matt Busby. The jerseys had arrived from Manchester on December the 30th, 1957. In January 1958, I stood in the Stretford Inn in Old Trafford in Manchester, and on a night enveloped in fog, I watched in wonder as Duncan Edwards, Liam Whelan, Mark Jones, Eddie Coleman, Roger Byrne and others took on the might of Real Madrid. However, one special memory remains etched in my mind, and that was the display of Manchester United's goalkeeper, as he saved his side time after time with some magnificent saves. Hento, Puskas, Di Stefano, the Madrid greats, peppered him with shots. His fielding in the box was superb, and his bravery, most of all, shone out like a beacon of light on that foggy night in Old Trafford. And now, 44 years later, it's a great honour and privilege to sit across the table here in the studios of Radio Kerry opposite that legendary Manchester United and Irish goalkeeper. Harry Gregg, MBE, you're very welcome to Terrace Talk and very welcome to Kerry.
Thank you, Washi. I'm delighted you invited me. I'm very proud and happy to be here.
And not forgetting a very special welcome to your wife, Caroline.
Thank you. Can I set her over there? I'm glad you came with me. I'd never have found my way without you, love.
First thing I'm going to say to you, Harry, MBE. Harry Gregg, MBE. You better explain that to us because we haven't very many MBEs down around here.
It makes me laugh when you talk about it, Washi, because shortly after Munich, I knew there was a possibility for the wrong reasons I might get one. I was invited to the Yugoslav embassy. I turned it down because of my state of mind at that point in time. I was happy to have my life. I didn't need anything else. And over the years, I never gave it a thought. And then about 8 years ago, my wife said to me, the little hotel, there's an envelope up the bank. You better come and see it. I said, I don't. Somebody's looking for autographs. Check it out and I'll sign them. She said, I want you to come and see it. So eventually, being pestered, as usually wives do, I went up, and it was from Buckingham Palace, asking me, would I accept an MBE if I were offered? And I said to my wife, I'll think about it. I think about it. And I did think about it. And to be honest with you, maybe I could have had 1 year before. It's not something I wanted. And eventually I decided, yes, provided I could take an honour of two things. To me, the greatest Irish player of all time, who I had played with and been managed by, the great Peter Docherty, and a memory of the boys that didn't make it from Munich. And I accepted the BBE, but the MBE, under those circumstances.
Member of the British Empire, would I
Member of the British Empire. I went to Buckingham Palace. I met His Royal Highness Prince Charles. Afterwards, when I came out with three of my family, there was lines of photographers, £40 a head, to have your photograph taken with your MBE and your top hat. And I said, now I'm wearing a top hat, tails, and pinstripe trousers. And I said, I'm not hanging about here. And I walked across the courtyard of Buckingham Palace, hailed the taxi, got the family in and cleared off home.
Well, Harry Gregg, you were born in Mallifelt, County Derry, on October the 25th, 1932. You played with Linfield Rangers, Linfield Swifts and Coleraine. You joined Doncaster Rovers in October 1952 as a 19-year-old for a fee of £2,000. And you won 8 Northern Ireland caps when you were with Doncaster. Were you always going to be a professional footballer and were you always going to be a goalkeeper?
I lived for football, but as a young boy in those days, I was captain of my country as a Scope International. I was captain of the under-14 international team, and in the same team was the great Jackie Blanchflower, the great, late, sadly, Jackie Blanchflower. I went, like all boys did in those days, to the local YM. I did a fair bit of boxing. I got to the semi-final of the Northern Ireland Championships, got a bye in the semi-final, into the final, and I was so proud and big-headed. Got in for the final, and a fellow from Roosevelt Street battered the head off me, and I gave up the boxing. I was a very good gymnast, used to give exhibitions, but the heart of it all, I was a left back playing football, as they called in those days, and they thought I was a little bit too rough at school, so they put me in goals. And I played there for the next 30 years, and I hated every minute of being a goalkeeper because it was like being in a cage, Wishy. I wasn't allowed outside the 18-yard line.
Even though you used to go outside, and you used to go outside and you weren't supposed to go outside. Because the night I saw you playing first time back 54 years ago, you were going out around the middle of the field doing a lot of roaring and shouting.
Yes, possibly so. I remember playing before I made the big time. And it was the big time when you joined Manchester United. I suppose at Doncaster, I was their big fish in a small pool. Again, repeat under the great Peter Doherty. And we played Fulham. And the guy you see in television England now, Jimmy Hill, used to call him the rabbi. Pass the ball to the rabbi. But I remember playing there one day, and I was coming for everything, and come outside the 18-yard line and headed the ball away. And a few minutes later, Jimmy Hill said to one of the players in the Fulham, somebody get into the box for that big clown. And Tommy Kavanagh, who went on to become coach at United, said, you go in, Jimmy, and you try him out. And Jimmy said, no, I don't think it'll bother.
Of course, you hold a unique record. You hold, you have amateur and school by league and international caps for your country. So I'm going to fast forward ahead a small bit to 1958 in the World Cup in Sweden. Six counties, six small, tiny counties. Now, we're 52 down here. We're down to the World Cup finals. But six small counties went to Sweden, and they shocked the world. They went to the quarterfinals of the World Cup. And we'll talk about the games now. But when it was over, the experts picked the best 11 players in the world, and you were in goal. Talk to us about that time, Harry.
That came out, I think, about to do some sort of a setup and do checking out about 2 months after the finals. And they picked what they would be, the world team, what they, from their opinion, was the world team. They picked other players as well. And the number of votes from the journalists at the time and experts at the time, I was very fortunate and still am very proud to come out as in the same team as Pelé, in the same team as Santos, in the same team as Garrincha, the little bird, all those great players. To be at the party alone was a great, great honour to me. Yes, I'm very proud that I was picked as the World Cup goalkeeper in the World Cup.
Harry, that World Cup in 58, what was it like to play in a World Cup final for your country? And talk to us about the players. I know you were injured for one of the games, and in particular for the French game, the last game, the two goalkeepers were injured. Peter Uprichard, was it Uprichard?
Ignore me, you're Pritchard, yes.
But he was injured and you were injured, you shouldn't have played. Talk to us about the players you played against.
The players I played against...
In that World Cup now.
The players I played... Actually, to be honest with you, O'Shea, if some of the countries today drew the people that we drew at the time, they wouldn't turn up. We drew in the prelims, we drew Italy, who had been world champions. We drew Portugal. We were beaten 1-0 in the Olympic Stadium in Rome by Italy. In Belfast, there were sadly two games because of a riot in one of the games, and the crowd rushed the field. We beat them in the second game at Windsor Park. We beat Portugal 4 at Windsor Park. We drew with them out there. And then the draws in the final were Czechoslovakia, West Germany, ruling champions at the time, and Argentina. And France after that for the semi-final. Now, a lot of people today wouldn't turn up when they hear those. It was wonderful to play against teams from... But I was lucky enough to have them played in the European Cup a few games with Manchester United, which was a good grounding. Against great players like the Real Madrids of this world and Benfica's and Red Star Belgrade. But to compete against the best is wonderful. To be there against Helmut Rahn, Uwe Seeler, the German team, the captain. I met some of them recently at the European Cup final, and they said, yes, Greg, I was 37. You were 27. I said, yeah, it's an excuse because we still beat you. But to play in those competitions and play with all the Irish team, Jackie Blindfleur, Danny Blindfleur, Tommy Casey, Jimmy McElroy, Big Peter McParland, all of them.
Wilbur Cush,
the most underrated player in the history of Irish football. But could I interrupt and say one thing? The support, and I do not patronise by nature, never will, the support that I had from the people of Ireland is incredible. It is incredible. And no one could be happier. I couldn't be happier if I was going to Korea this time with the Republic of Ireland, because they were so good to us when we broke the sound barrier. And we had so many supporters, it was incredible. We broke the sound barrier that little time in 58, and they supported us all the way. And I support them, and I would be happy for them as if I were going myself.
Lovely, well said. On Thursday, December the 19th, 1957, you joined Man United for £23,000, a world record then for a goalkeeper. And you beat the previous best. That was paid by Chelsea for Coventry's rigged matches. You beat it by £1,000. But United were kind of going to hesitate, I think, a bit in taking you. They didn't want to pay the extra few bob for the Irishman. Is that right?
So I believe. We were never really involved in the financial side of it. Sheffield Wednesday had made a bid of something like £18,000 about a month before to Doncaster Rovers, and they said I wasn't going anywhere. And then out of the blue, I had no knowledge of it at all, I was told that I should report after training at 2 o'clock to the medical room at Old Trafford, told to go across the pitch, get into the back of a car, in state car, pull a blanket over my head, and I was driven to the manager's house where I'd never been before. And I went and met Peter Doherty, the manager, and he said, Manchester United want to sign you. Matt Busby's coming over to sign you. So I said, boss, I had a wonderful time at Doncaster. Do I get anything out of it? Oh, I said, no, we'd rather keep you than sell you. I thought, well, what the hell am I doing here at your house? And just with that, there was a knock on the door, and in came this Matt Busby and Jimmy Murphy. I'd never met before. I'd watched them and heard about them.
Harry, no, that was the first time you saw Matt Busby.
Yes.
What struck you about him when you saw him for the first time ever?
The best way to describe it was Peter. They had been played against. Peter turned and said, Matt, the boy is ready to go. And Matt said, no, Peter, I want to speak to the boy. So that immediately created an impression with me. Here I was getting sold down the river like a side of beef, and here the buyer was saying, no, I want to talk to the boy. And he turned to me and said, do you want to join Manchester United? And I immediately and too quickly replied, yes. He said, hold on, we don't pay any money. Do you still want to join Manchester United? Because I believe you back yourself in life, I said, I still want to join Manchester United. And I signed the forms. Doncaster Rovers got £23,500. I got what was called the accrued share of benefit, £37. But I would do it all again for less.
Actually, you're quoted as saying, it was the happiest day of my life. The only reason I did it was to better myself and provide more security for my wife and daughter, who's 2 months old. Is that right?
I would say that's near enough to be right. But the reason I wanted to, because I wanted to join what I considered then to be the Hollywood of football. And all these years have passed, and I've yet to be proved wrong. They are the Hollywood. They were the Hollywood of football.
Well, we have a man training the Kerry football team here, Paddy Sheehan. He described Kerry as the Manchester United of Gaelic football. So that's a little equivalent there. Harry, were United then, when you joined them, were they as big and as famous as they are now? Were they the very same? Like, it was the same aura there about them?
Yes. Yes, without the slightest doubt, you hadn't the same media coverage, but any coverage going went to Manchester United. The bulk of it went to United. We averaged 62,000 in those days. The stadium wasn't big enough. Okay, because of sentiment, I've been there on occasions where there were 62,000 in 70 minutes before the game, and they were sending out messages to say, don't turn up at the ground, it's packed. They were the Hollywood of football, without the slightest doubt.
You played your first game against Leicester City and you won 4-0. Now, were you nervous? What was it like tugging out in the dressing rooms in Old Trafford and going out before that crowd? What was the feeling like? What was it like? And were you very nervous?
No, it was something I'd worked for. It was something. Every player, or 99% of the players that play in the game, are uptight before the game in the dressing room. And I speak for myself and many, many thousands more. But once you walk down that tunnel, you become arrogant for some unknown right reason. And here was something I'd worked, I'd prayed for, and I'd got, so why should I be nervous and excited? I enjoyed every second of it. I remember in my first game colliding with Duncan Edwards and knocking him down and knocking him almost out, coming for a high ball. Because Ray, before me, was a good goalkeeper. Same age as Ray Wood was. But Ray was inclined to be more playing his line. Well, my nature, I hated the goal line. I believe that you didn't play from it, you played to it, so you're never near it. Why should I handicap myself when the ball was at the other end of the pitch by standing on my goal line? So I came for high balls and I clattered Duncan, and the lads kept saying, keep coming, big man, keep coming. And from that day on, that's how it worked.
You mentioned Duncan Edwards there. Now, we'll be talking about Munich later on in the show, but Duncan Edwards and all those players, that talk to me about those Roger Byrne and Tommy Taylor, and talk to me. Do you know, Harry, I must say this, Joe, the one thing that strikes me about all those players, we still see them as they are. They never got old.
That's right.
What, they never changed.
That's
every time you look at a book or a photo, you handed me photos tonight there now, you handed me some lovely leaflets which will be given out later on to the lads. But the one thing that strikes me, they're still the same, aren't they? How do you remember them playing with them now? That day in Old Trafford now?
There are those gone down a long, long road before us. Yet each morn we try and keep them in our sight. In memory's eyes, the Busby babes are all immortal. The Red Devil spirit lives. It never died. That's how I remember them. Mm-hmm. And I believe that.
Yeah. He had some great players around that time that he even couldn't get on the Manchester United team. And you were there when one of the greatest of all players arrived. And we'll talk about him now, because I want to make sure we get around him. And you were there when Georgie Best arrived in Old Trafford. As a matter of fact, did you have something to do with the signing of Best going to Old Trafford?
Well, I was there when the boy arrived on the scene.
Talk to us about him.
I'd been out with a bad injury and they said I might never play again, but I'd made up my mind I wasn't finished and I worked very hard at it. First team players never saw kids. Let's get that straight now. With the hypocrisy say otherwise. Very few of the staff saw the kids. And I asked the boss, could I go and work with the kids that were on trial? Each holiday period, they'd have them over from Dublin, from Belfast, from the south of England, from Scotland, from everywhere, from Wales, and they would have trials. These would be schoolboys in trials, and they would put these kids up in the halls of residence, and the scouts would watch them. Well, I asked, could I go and join in with these kids? And the boss said, you be careful.
Why did you want to go with them, Harry?
That was always been my nature. I just wanted to play football. I didn't care who it was with. I wanted to play. There's times that football has saved my sanity. I went across and I just got over the period in time where I was at the top, playing against the top players in the world. A man threw one on one. I would throw him a dummy before he threw me one. I used to think they're thick. It's not that I'm great, they're thick. Here I am playing with a bunch of schoolboys. This kid comes through in a five-a-side. I'm down in my backside. And I thought, phew, in my head, I don't like that. And it happened again. I thought, Christ, I haven't slipped that much. And it happened again. And I said to the kid, you do that again, I'll break your bloody neck, son. And got talking to this youngster and to other youngsters, and he was a very clean cut boy, a very quiet boy. Had a chat with him, became friendly. On the same day I met the boss, he asked me how I was. I told him coming along, and I said, by the way, have you seen the youngster from Belfast at the cliff? Short black hair and bright eyes. No. Within a few days he met me and he said, I know the boy you've been now. It's a pity he's too small. That was the beginning with George. George then went away and came back again. And I was Harry Gregg back in the team again, Irish international, and his father came over, Dick Best. George introduced me as a child to his dad, and I called him Mr. Best. I didn't call him Dick Best then. All I was a player of some repute. And he eventually asked me, did I think would George get a contract? And I said, Mr. Best, George will get a contract. The kid was doing it. It was amazing. And he said, what should I do? Now, remember, Wishy, I'm only a player. I said, look, I'm only a player. The only way I can advise you that if they offer him a contract, Noel, you insist that you're there when he signs the contract. And the sequel to that story is George got a contract. We played Leicester in the cup final of 62-63, which I didn't play in the final and didn't make me very good company. I was sitting with the first team celebrations after the game when this child came across and said, Harry, can my daddy come over and talk to you? And I said, no, George, son, I'll go and talk to your dad. And I went across in the hotel in London. Everybody was enjoying it. What can I do for you? He said, Harry, you told me if George were offered a contract that I should insist I'd be there. I said, yes. He said, well, they signed George Thursday and they brought us over this morning, us being his mother and father. What should I do? I said, look, Matt Busby, whether I'm in a mood with him tonight or not, as an honourable man, you must insist he keeps the promise. And Dick went looking for the boss, and the boss kept getting lost as far as he could get away. So that was the beginning of the George Best story. As time went on and he made the first team, and I think the best way to point it out is, at 17 years of age, he was in the first team. And I wasn't his minder, but I knew him when he was nobody. And I think you respect him because I know him a long time. And you knew at Old Trafford, if you're going to be dropped, you were told on a Thursday you wanted in the medical or in the referee's room. That was the execution chamber. The boss would be waiting there to say, how do you think you're doing? And if you're young and daft, you'll always say, I think you could be doing better. And he'd say, you're right, son, I'm going to give you a rest. But if I would be told I was wanted in the medical room, I went to the medical room. Ted Dalton, the boss's physio and spy, was there, a lovely fellow, but he was watching everything. The door was locked, and the boss said to me, will you, for God's sake, have a word with your mate, George Best? So I said, what is it, boss? And he said, he's running with a Jewish girl that has left her husband, and they're after him. And he's running, now Matt didn't swear a lot, he's running with the biggest bloody whore masters and gamblers in Manchester. I should know, because I ran with their grandparents. And he put £100 in a blackjack card last night. Will you, for God's sake, go on a war with him? Now, I think that's a clever man.
Was that the start of
17 years of age.
Yeah.
So, I would go out and do a bit of training, meet him doing all that, and say, here. Now, I mean, as easy as this. Here, boy, I want you. What is it? I had a lot of good Jewish friends in this city before you ever arrived. And they've marked my card, boy. They're after you. You run, I swear I've stopped, Harry, I swear I've stopped. And you run away so-and-so-and-so-and-so, and you put £100 in the blackjack card last night. Chuck it. I didn't, don't tell me lies, chuck it out. That was my association with George Best. And the final time was, to give you a pointer to it in his playing career, we played Partizan Belgrade my last year in the European Cup. We went out there in the first round, and we were beaten 2-0. George got a bad injury. Dennis had a nightmare. Dennis had a nightmare. We should have beaten him, but we didn't. And we came back and George was injured. We were playing Arsenal on the Saturday. And the boss was a very quiet man on a Saturday. He did his talking on a Friday. He didn't do a lot of talking on a Saturday. And before the game, as people were uptight, getting prepared, I said to the boss, where's the little fella? And Matt Busby turned to me and he said, I've let him go home to see his mother and father. He's in St. Joseph's tomorrow for a cartilage operation. We all went there for our injuries. So I thought, heat of the moment, I'll go and see him maybe during the week. He played the game, emotional, big tight game, Arsenal. I forget all about it. On the following Thursday morning, I'm told, you're wanted in the medical room. Down I go, door locked. And I don't want to mention names, but he asked me, did I know a certain man in Belfast? And I said, no, I don't know him, but I've heard of him. Now, was he, maybe I have a silly sense of humour. He said, what is he? I said, he's the Irish equivalent of an African witch doctor. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, they rub bones together, but he puts his hands on you and you're better. That is my nature. I said, why, boss? He said, George won't have the operation. I said, what do you mean? He said, he only came back this morning. He's been to see this man. This man has treated him. The father took him there, and George has refused to have the operation. Will you, for Christ's sake, talk to him? I don't have to tell fairy tales, will she?
Yeah. Did he have the operation after?
No. So I went out training. I go out and do, as I told you before, do a bit of training. We were training at the Ship Canal, the supporters ground. I do a couple of laps. Here, boy, I want you. What is it? I said, where the hell have you been? He said, my daddy took me down to see so-and-so-and-so-and-so, and he did this and that and the other, and I'm better. I said, George, you've seen the best medical people that money can pay for here at United. You've been to see some man in Belfast, and he's put his hands on you, and you're better. He said, aye. I said, George, what did he look like? He said, what do you mean? I said, what did he look like? Was he a big, tall fella like me? Did he have a big white robe on him? did he have a crown? He said, I said, George, it must have been Jesus Christ you've seen. I said, you've seen the best that money can supply, and you've met some fella put his hands up. And George said, as usual, you're mad. I said, no, son, you're mad. Within the next half hour, George was carted away with his leg locked, had an operation, and almost died because he got phlebitis.
Oh, yeah.
And got a clot. So that is my basic background. I don't know, was George Best. I don't want to be going about saying that George Best was the greatest player I've seen, the greatest player I ever played with, because I don't believe it.
Who was the best player you ever saw, Harry, when you had it?
The greatest player I ever saw, all round, was an Irishman. Peter the Great Doherty, who played for Manchester City. And there's no hesitation in my mind, when you play from 17 till you're 40, when you can carry greatness, the most important thing, to be worshipped by your fellow pros, and anybody speaks about Peter the Great, the Shankleys, the Mercers, all the great ones, worship the ground he walked on.
Well, that answers a lot of questions. To the Manchester United Supporters Club, Sir Harry Gregg, one of the legends of Manchester United, goalkeeper, and here are many supporters. We extend a warm welcome to you and your wife, and look forward to meeting you after the show. That's from the Killarney branch. A lot of branches of United men around here, and there's another one up there in Abbey Field in District, Manchester United Supporters Club. We wish Harry Gregg long life and happiness, and we thank you for giving us a chance to air our club on the show. The best of luck to Harry Gregg, and we're delighted to see him in Kerry. Pat Reedy says, he's in early, a sincere welcome to the kingdom for Harry Gregg. How would Harry compare the Busby Babes and the game they played in relation to the game today? Quick one before we go to the comment line. How would you compare the Busby Babes with the Manchester United team? That had to come up, Harry.
Two of them might get into the squad that I joined away back in 1957, and they would be lucky.
Well, we'll see what they meant. Well, no, Harry, Jimmy McGee is Ireland's best, and I can tell you, his best loved sports commentator and writer. And we were honored to have him here as our special guest in Terrace Talk earlier on in the year, and he now joins us to pay his tribute and talk about you, because you have met the great Jimmy McGee. Jimmy McGee, you're very welcome back to Terrace Talk.
Hello, Harry.
Hello, Jim. After all these years.
It's lovely to hear you. I can tell you one difference, Wishy, between the Busby Babes and the present team.
Away with you.
The bigger bank balance is now. I mean, Beckham earns more in a week than Harry probably earned in his whole life.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
That's all. That has nothing to do with football. How do I remember Harry Gregg, Wishy? As a light, athletic, supple, fearless goalkeeper. And there are a lot of great moments in Harry's life, not least of which was Wembley 57, when Northern Ireland beat England. 3-2, I think it was. And that England team would have included people like Duncan Edwards and Tommy Taylor and Roger Byrne, who perished, I'm afraid, in that awful tragedy in Munich. And then there was the Harry Gregg who went under the managership and the coaching of Peter Doherty to Sweden in 1958, when we looked at the television through old grainy black and white. And this little team from the north that didn't even have enough players to make a full squad, it drew people like Czechoslovakia, it was all together then, Argentina and West Germany, if you don't mind, and got a win and a draw out of three lots, then got through to meet Czechoslovakia again, and in Norrköping, I remember well, before they went out. And they ended up, I think Harry would will straighten me on this, when it came up to the final match or the final couple of matches, they really had no fit goalkeeper. Norman Yap-Richard was one goalkeeper, Harry Gregg was the other, and the question I seem to remember from those days was, who would be fit enough? Not who would be fit, but who would be fit enough to play. Is that right, Harry?
100% right, Jim. Who would be daft enough to play? You're 100% correct.
And you got the short straw.
I got the short straw, and I'm glad I did, even in defeat.
Jimmy, what does Harry Gregg mean to Irish sport, and we'd say the legend of Manchester United?
Well, he means so much because he's one of the links with that. There's his greatness as a footballer, and his longevity as a man, and his niceness as a fellow, and his heroism in Munich. Alas, they couldn't get all of them out. But the 58 Cup final was another thing we remember well, because if I may go back just for a moment, in 57, I think it was, Peter McParland from Uri had a clash with Wood, the Manchester United goalkeeper, when Aston Villa won the cup, and the following year, when Man U were back with the shattered remnants of the team from Munich, Harry Gregg was bundled, bounced...
by Nat Loftus.
By Nat Loftus, and we all hated Nat Loftus.
Jim, stay with us, we're going talking to another goalkeeper, but he's a Kerry goalkeeper. He played in goal for Kerry in the All-Ireland final in 1972, Harry, before 70,000 people. He's a great fan of yours all your life. He's Eamon Fitzgerald. He's in Dublin. Eamon, you're welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Weezy, and hello there to Harry Gregg. Great to talk to him after reading about him for so many years.
Right, Eamon, away with you. What does he mean, Eamon, to
you? Well, of course, first of all, welcome to Harry to the heartland of Gaelic football.
Thank you, Eamon.
But even in the heartland of Gaelic football, there is tremendous support for Manchester United. And I remember in primary school hearing about this Harry Gregg and this great hero with the tragic crash of the Man United players. And ever afterwards, I followed United. And there's a tremendous support for United in Kerry. I suppose, Weezy, you would know best of all, the Larney man there, John Lyne, known as Lino, who dresses in red and white all the time and does everything in red and white.
And owns the Stretford Inn Bar.
That's right. And in fact, an interesting thing is that he's a big promoter of Lotto for the local football club. And every week he buys a ticket for a Manchester United supporter. And one week, Cantona, during his time in United, I won £25, and he insisted on going over to Old Trafford and giving him the £25. So that's the kind of support, even in a very Gaelic area.
That's wonderful, Eamon. Thank you very much for the tributes. I'm only here as part of the club. I wish he was still part of the playing side of it.
Right. Can I just ask you there, Harry, as I'm on, what do you need to be an international goalkeeper? In particular, a goalkeeper now, obviously.
The most important things is that if you're lucky enough to have a decent physique, that helps a lot. You don't have to be 6'19", but 6 foot's handy, 5'11" is okay. To be able to command your 18-yard line, to control your area and to control your defenders, that is the most important thing. I did a dinner with Noel Campbell from Cork recently in the Burlington in Dublin, and he did a piece of me which I didn't like, but I suppose it's true. He said the opposition were terrified of him. When he came for high balls, you could hear bones cracking all the time. He said the most frightening thing of all, I don't know whether his own back four were more bloody afraid of him than the opposition, because he hurt them as well. You've got to be commanding. I mean, people talk about Barthez at this point in time because he's having a little bit of a rough spell.
Right.
Now, you play the game that you play, and there's movement, there's skill, and there's courage, and the most important thing is the will to win, no matter what position you play in any sport. The will to win after a little bit of ability. We have Barthez, who's been crucified at the present time. Mm. Would you like to see him standing under the bar, sheltering from the rain, when they're heading balls in for 4 yards out, and they're saying the poor goalkeeper has no chance? I love the Barthezes of this world.
God, very, very good. Can I just mention briefly, and I know you probably have many people trying to get in, Harry.
Hi, Gavin.
Two Irish players, United players, that I had a particular interest in, and I'd like you just maybe to comment briefly on them. First of all, my favourite, of course, Geordie Best, a world-class player with tremendous natural talent, often remembered for the bad things, but I will still remember him as the supreme artist on the ball. And also Kevin Moran, who was an outstanding Gaelic footballer, came very late into soccer. And I was amazed for a lad that played on just junior soccer, he was able to make it at United level and also at international level. You might like just a comment on the two of those, Harry.
George, I think you heard me saying earlier in the programme, I've known St. Hughes. George had everything. But I would put it in relation to this very briefly. I set up doing a tribute to Matt Busby in front of 13,000 when he died. Matt Busby's face never changed. He had the face of humility. He was able to carry greatness. Although George had all those gifts, he was not able to carry the can of greatness. And George robbed himself, as well as robbing the rest of us, of seeing what should have been the complete and total thing.
Kevin Moran didn't, Harry?
Kevin Moran I was talking about today, I love Kevin Moran. I joined Old Trafford as a coach many years after I left. And even at my age, I would be in first, down to the gym, working out. And in the remedial gym, this young fella came around, shook my hand, Dublin accent, and said, I always wanted to meet you, my name's Kevin Moran. he joined a month before me. Within two or three months, Kevin Moran came to me. Now, I'm only a coach. And he said, Harry, I'd like to have a word with you. I said, what is it, son? He said, do you think I'm good enough to play for Manchester United? I said, why do you ask me that? He said, because I'm not the sort that would hang around, even at Old Trafford, if I wasn't good enough to make the first team. Well, I thought, what a fantastic attitude, because most of it stars in her eyes. And Gordon McQueen, a dear lad, was in the team. And I said, you shouldn't be asking me, but can I tell you something now, Kevin? And I mean this. I said, Kevin, I would rather play 42 games a season against Gordon McQueen with no boots on than play two bloody games against you, because you're the hardest bastard I've ever run into. And I was only 47 at the time. I love Muggsy Moran, and he made a great move from Gaelic football. In fact, he played Gaelic football for you after he was playing for United. He took time off to come home.
Eamon, does that answer your question?
That answers my question, and I know you've a lot of people to get on.
No, listen, thanks.
Also, you may realise, of course, well there, Harry, that Weechi was also very keen on the goalkeeping position there, and he played goalkeeping for a long time as well.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us, Eamon. Okay. Thank you. Jimmy, you're still with us?
Oh, I'm still with you. Just
Jimmy, how will this man rate in the legends of goalkeepers?
Well, from Doncaster Rovers, he joined Manchester United. I think it was a world record fee for a goalkeeper at the time.
That's right.
£24,000 or thereabouts. They never really truly revealed these. But I'm talking about a way back. That was massive money. And he kept a wonderful goal in a wonderful club. And don't forget, he was one of the couple of links with the team that perished and the team that thrived. He was also on the first Irish team from this island that ever qualified for a World Cup final, and was up against the best of them in the World Cup in which the great Pelé first came to world notice. But when his days were finished as a footballer, I, with the producer Ian Corr, went once to England to do some feature programs for RTE Radio. And one of the ones we wanted to do was do a piece with Harry Gregg. And we got the train to Crewe, walked up to Gresty Road, and met this man who was managing Crewe Alexandra at the time. And if you manage Crewe Alexandra, you're kind of a jack of all trades. You have to coach, manage, wash out the dressing room, make the tea. And that he did that day. And he couldn't have been more generous in his way. Well, then I'm not surprised he's a dairy.
Come here, Jimmy. He's crossing a huge divide tonight because he's the first world-class international soccer player being interviewed on Radio Kerry. In Kerry, for that matter. What do you think of that?
Yeah, but I'll tell you this. Do you see in Kerry, whether you play in goal or football, they know their football.
Jim, before I let you go, I was into a bookshop the other day. I see you have another quiz book on the shelves.
Yes, ask Jimmy. Without last year, actually, and did very well, and the publishers decided they'd give it a go again this year.
Yeah.
That's the one with Pelé on the cover. And that's a real photograph. It's not a making-up photograph. Questions that have been asked, will be asked, and should be asked. Some interesting anecdotal ones in it. It's not really a hardcore quiz book. It's anecdotal, like who was the Kerry man, or rather, the fellow called Kerry who won an Irish boxing title. Who was the Dublin man who won the British Open? Who was the man from County Derry on the World Cup team in 58 and the man from County Derry who managed the team? Is Derry the most musical county in Ireland? This is all for your benefit, Harry.
I've got three answers already, Jim.
He's writing down the answers here. Jimmy.
Peter Doherty, Faye Coyle, and Danny Boy.
Go
on.
Faye Coyle.
And the...
Peter Doherty.
The Ask Jimmy book has some very good pictures.
Jimmy.
A picture of George Best.
Yes.
With a whole lot of unknown guys, all of whom think they're known.
That's right.
Fellows like Brendan Boyer and that.
Jimmy, it's always nice to talk to you.
So there you are. You don't have to buy it. I'll get you a copy.
Do, and listen to me. We'll wrap it up for you and tell us talk.
It's lovely to be talking to Harry Gregg, a true legend.
And Jimmy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Thank you, Jimmy. Jimmy McGee, the great Jimmy McGee. He sat in your chair there for an hour and a half, not so long ago. Actually, you helped his program, didn't you?
I did.
You did. We're just going for a break now. Sorry that I can't be with you on the big night. Please wish Harry every success for the future. And on behalf of the Tralee branch of the Manchester United Supporters Club, I hope that he has an enjoyable stay in Kerry. Regards, Johnny Switzer. Stay with us until it's done. Christmas card, would you believe? The very first Christmas card but to Harry Gregg. And do you know who it comes from? It comes from the Kerry G. And Harry, how do you think of that?
Yes.
The nice, the card was produced by the Communications Committee of the Kerry G County Board, and it'll be available at the end of this week from the Kerry County Board office in Tralee, and also at the County Board meeting tonight in Killarney. There's
thank
a big Kerry G County Board meeting. So that's especially nice for us, isn't it?
I might get a game even.
You might, yeah. But the card was designed by Michelle O'Mahony, a 6-year student at intermediate school, and Harry and Caroline Gregg are the first to receive the card, signed specially and all for you, Harry.
Thank you very much indeed.
Nice job, isn't it?
A beautiful job, yes indeed.
Yeah?
I've got my glasses out and read this now.
You better, yeah. Anyway, Harry, listen, a few messages. Do you remember the incident in 1959, Mick O'Neill? I imagine maybe he's talking about the incident in the cup final that Nat Loftus, we were just talking about here, knocked you out. That was 1958.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that incident. And Jimmy McGee was on about it. That's the one that, Harry, we're talking about. United.
Yeah.
Nat knocks us on with one charge. You were knocked out. Talk to us about that, the cup final.
Well, we had got through to the cup final, I think we got through. Basically on sentiment, the whole world was on our side and the whole world was against anyone that played us. And we beat Sheffield Wednesday in the first game, I think 3-4-0. We went to West Brom against all odds and drew with West Brom. Vic Buckingham, the manager of the then West Brom team, said there would be no sympathy, they would take us apart. We took them back to Old Trafford and beat them 1-0. That was Bobby Charlton's first game back. He hadn't played in the team up till then. We then drew Fulham. And we drew with them at Villa Park. They were going to take us apart. We were riding really on sentiment. And I must say, from my own point of view, everything that happened for quite a amount of time after the crash for me was an anti-climax, where one would be uptight as you would be, was you, before a game. It was an anti-climax. It's something you had to do. We drew with Fulham to a piece at Villa Park, went to Highbury on a very foggy day, and beat them, I think, 5-3, and we were through to the cup final. But the best way to describe it is, if you play at Wembley, and I was lucky enough to play at Wembley after and before I joined United, but it's a great, it was a wonderful feeling, and you're meeting celebrities, and it was the year that we were told that we mustn't chew chewing gum, which all players do when we speak to royalty. So here I am standing at Wembley, and it was Prince Philip. As he gets up to me, I think, oh Christ, I shouldn't be chewing chewing gum. So I reached up to my mouth to take the chewing gum out of my mouth, made a mistake, took out my right hand and shook hands with His Royal Highness with the chewing gum in my hand.
Yes.
But that was the time. We did not play well against Bolton, and Harry Gregg didn't play well against Bolton.
Talk to us about the incident that Ned Lofthouse collided with you.
All I can tell you is this, Wishy, that if I had been looking at him, he wouldn't have collided with me. I parried a ball and tried to palm it over the bar and didn't do it too well. I was lucky enough, I turned, was able to catch it, and when I turned my back, Nat nails me. That happens. The people talk about me getting hit, but God forbid, when it comes your turn, you take it and you don't scream about it.
Were you knocked unconscious?
No, I didn't know where I was. I had injections in the bottom of my spine after the game and in the back of my neck, but it was a thump and a bump, and to me, in any sport, you give one and you take one and you don't moan about it. It was a foul. Today it would only be GBH, about 6 months in bloody jail, but that's the way sports changed.
Mike O'Neill, that's probably the one you're talking about now. Lovely to hear Harry, Bernadette O'Sullivan. Was George Best the best ever player to come out of Northern Ireland? Michael O'Sullivan, Cassavine, was he the best ever? I think you said Peter Doherty.
Yes, well,
you covered that. Did you know the striker, Tommy Taylor, did you know the striker, Tommy Taylor? You played with him, of course.
I played with him, and yeah. I played against him. I played for Ireland against him at Wembley.
That was a knock and O'Neill from Abbey Neil.
Yes.
Do you think Man United will win the Premiership, Dolores, once and all that?
I think they're still capable of winning the Premiership, even at a low ebb at this point in time.
Harry, this is from Jack Kelleher and Ash Street in Tralee. Did it take you long to start travelling by plane again after the accident?
I travelled back from the World Cup in Sweden, and let me see, it would be May, June, in June. I didn't enjoy it, but I made up my mind I have to travel again, and I travelled back from Sweden to Heathrow, and then from then to Notts Corner in Belfast.
Massey Horn from Mullen and Scatterglen is wishing you well.
Thank you very
what
much.
What are your thoughts of George Best, Margaret Reedy? You spoke about George already. I know Margaret Reedy. She's out, a lady out in Curragh, a great woman, married with a family, works very hard at the GAA. That's Margaret Reedy. Lovely to hear you. Helen Griffin from Lisbon. Duncan Edward, would he have been the best, she says. Would Duncan have been the best? We spoke about Duncan. How good was he, Harry?
Potentially, Duncan would have been the best. But Duncan was on his way. Potential is something that's not fulfilled. Duncan would have been the best. I don't like saying if in life. He never had the chance to fulfill his potential. He was a wonderful...
Well, he'd been like a tank.
Yeah, people think Duncan was a giant. Duncan was about 5'10", built like the proverbial brick shit house, thighs, shoulders, a lot. And I likened to Roy Keane, and proud that I did. Many years ago, when Keane went to United, all they were calling this guy was a thug. I mean, there's no hiding that we're calling him. Now they're all calling him what a great player. I did a piece which upset people. I said that the nearest thing I will ever see to Duncan Edwards was Roy Keane. People have this great image that Duncan would go past you like a beautiful bird. If Duncan couldn't go past you, he would go through you. Keane is the same. The only difference is that Roy, at that point in time, was lifting his hands, and I think that's a great compliment.
Mick Lyon said, how come Paddy Finucane has changed from being a Gaelic supporter to a Manchester United supporter?
I was here to play football at Dalymount Park.
Yeah?
I went with Big Eddie McMahon and Lenny Graham, and we went to Croke Park. And we watched this hurling game, and I have never seen a bigger crowd in my life, nor a more lively one.
But Seamus Mahoney would know, because he's older than you, does
he,
Harry?
Oh, is he? Right.
What was, Harry, this is from Paul Cratty Killarney. What was the highlight of your Manchester United career in comparison to Manchester United now? What was the highlight of your career?
Signing for them.
Lovely. This is from PJ Holland. Do you think, nice question, do you think there will be an All-Ireland soccer team?
No.
No, why?
Because there was one. And it used to give me great pleasure in my hotel when people said there should be an All. I said there was an All-Ireland team up until 1947-48. And then they decided, that's fact. Did you know that? I have the last programme. With Johnny Carey, Peter Doherty, Baldy Gorman, the whole lot. And I had the team, and I had the programme, and I'm proud of it. But it'll never happen again, sadly. Nothing to do with politics, to do with money.
One of the highlights of your career, I read somewhere back along through the years, was the day and the night that you beat England in Wembley 3-2. Now, before you went out, you must tell us the story in the tunnel about what Tom Finney said to you, because you had played in an Irish league team, and you had led in 9 goals. Is that right?
I actually... You could laugh.
Well, you came back then with Northern Ireland and you won 3-2. Talk us about was it Tom Finney said something?
Billy Wright.
Talk to us about that, Harry.
I played against the English League when I was 18-19, and the English League team was Merrick, Ball and Garrett, Wright, Froggatt and Dickinson, Finney, Pearson, Lofthouse, Brodus and Rowley. A full international team. 45,000 at Windsor Park, and we stuffed 9-0. The only time our centre forward touched the ball was every time we centred after they scored. And I thought, I'm ruined. I mean, I'm ruined. In front of 45,000 Irish people, a young fella. I didn't go to work for days. I was honest to God afraid to go for a haircut. I was terrified. I got back in a short time after returning to Coleraine. I was transferred to England. And lo and behold, was an eye pick 57 for Ireland against England. I'll tell you a very strange and funny story to do with the Irish outlook. Our manager was Peter Doherty. I keep repeating Peter the Great. Danny Blanchflower was the captain, and Jerry Morgan was a trainer, this huge big man that had played for Nottingham Forest. He had no teeth and he was bald, and he carried a toothbrush and a comb. Now work out for yourself. Now there's 24 selectors walking around Wembley, and we're walking behind them, subservient. And they're saying, isn't it great for wee Ireland to be able to play at Wembley? Isn't it great for wee Ireland? And Jerry Morgan spoke up and said, excuse my language, great my arse, the Greyhounds have been running here for 100 years. We went out the following day to play the great Wembley, I think the great England the first time. You're Duncan Edwards, you're Billy Wright, you're Roger Burns, you're Tommy Taylors. And I'm standing in the tunnel, and across from me is the captain of England, a lovely man. And he walked across to me, Billy Wright from my original team, and he said, "You've come a long way, son, haven't you?" And I said, "Aye." But the most important thing is, we went out and we won. It was a great, great, great time.
What was it like, Harry, to beat England in Wembley 3-2?
Wait, for coming to the club, talk to us about... Did you go ahead today? Go ahead. Talk to us about how the game went.
We went ahead from the start. And funny, it was a lad in that team, 31, 32 years of age, Sammy McCrory from Southend. And he scored one of the goals. Let me see, a penalty kick, which Jimmy, I think it was the second goal, Jimmy McElroy hit. It hit the post, bounced back, and hit Eddie Hopkinson in the back of the back, and bounced into the net, which put us two up. Then let me see who scored. Alan Lacourt scored, who played for Liverpool, and then Duncan hammered one in.
Duncan Edwards, your own teammate.
My own teammate. I wasn't his teammate at the time, but playing in front of me was his teammate, the great Jackie Blanchflower, the great late Jackie Blanchflower. And Jackie completely and totally that day destroyed Tommy Taylor, who was a colleague, and they were the closest of friends. Jackie said after Tommy died, just a few years before he died, "I never found another friendship like Tommy Taylor." And funny, on that day, he completely blotted them out. We got to the stage where... Look, I would have wished the game had gone on forever. It was the first time in history, by the way, that Wembley was raided. And we were carried off the field by hundreds and hundreds of crazy Irishmen. And I didn't say Northern Irishmen, I said Irishmen. We were carried off the pitch, and I was carried off the pitch. Walter Winterbottom was the then manager of England, and he was interviewed after the game, and he was asked, "What did he think?" And he said, "Good luck to the Irish," but he felt they were a very lucky team on the day.
Yeah.
And Danny Blanchflower was interviewed immediately afterwards, and they told him what Walter had said, and Danny said, "That could be very true, but if it is true, I'd rather be a lucky team than a good team."
Harry, was that the highlight of your career?
That was a fantastic... That was international career. That would be international career, yes, plus getting to the World Cup.
Stay with us on Terrace Talk. Tom and Klein, you're admiring that Christmas card there that's issued by the Kerry GAA supporters, or the Kerry GAA County Board, and you're anxious to read a little verse. There's a lot of verses you'd like to read one verse, you said.
The first and the last, I like. I'll read you the last. "Leave the door upon the latch, and set the fire to keep, and pray they'll rest with us tonight when all the world's asleep." I think very touching. Lovely. Very good.
Looks
very nice.
Now, Harry, we're trying to get through all your career tonight, which is, of course, impossible, even in 2 hours that we have. It's impossible. But I want to touch another part of your career before I get to this. The management side, when you gave up playing, you went into management. And the first team that you managed was Shrewsbury Town.
Yes.
A team I saw playing myself, would you believe? Because my late brother lived in Shrewsbury, and he's buried in Shrewsbury, and I'd visit him, and he'd bring me to see him. Now, there's a man in the line who's commentator, the sports commentator with Radio Shropshire and the BBC. He's Sean Fogarty, a great Man City and Shrewsbury Town supporter. Sean, you're very welcome to Terrace Talk.
Cheers, Richie. You very nearly called me a Manchester United fan there, and that would have seen me hang up on you.
Listen to me, that wouldn't go down too well. Sean, listen to me. Harry and coaching Shrewsbury Town, how is he remembered? And talk to, bring home some memories to him about Shrewsbury.
Well, Harry Gregg took over in 68, and he had a very, very tough act to follow. There's a gentleman here called Arthur Rowley, who probably doesn't mean much in Ireland, but he is the league's top goal scorer ever. He scored more goals in English football than anybody else. More than Dixie Dean, more than George Best, more than Bobby Charlton, more than Dennis Law, more than Bob Latchford, more than anybody. This guy is a living legend. He's still around, God bless him. But he was at Shrewsbury for years and years and years. And he scored, I think he scored nearly 500 goals, and he scored 150 of those with Shrewsbury Town. And he was manager immediately before Harry. So Harry had a tough act to follow. To give you an idea, when Arthur Rowley was in charge, he had 10 years at the club, and they reached, this is Shrewsbury Town, a third division club, they reached the last 16 of the FA Cup twice, and they were a well-respected club under Arthur. And that's the tough act that Harry had to follow, and he did it seamlessly.
Why do you say, what did he do, Sean? What did he achieve?
He brought in all kinds of players who were still remembered around the town. A lot of them still live here. You can tell, Harry, that I'm going out with Jake King tonight.
Wonderful.
Jake King, I think you brought him as a 15-year-old from Glasgow.
As a boy, yes indeed.
And Jake is a good friend of mine.
Lovely boy.
He's just been awarded Manager of the Month for his success with Telford United in the conference. They won 4 out of 4 in November.
I remember Jake, I had made up my mind that he would play in the first team at Torquay.
Yeah.
And he was a lovely boy, quiet boy. He was only about 16 at the time, but I admit, Jimmy McLaughlin was my coach. Very good coach. And Jimmy and I had made up our mind, but Jimmy came to me in desperation on the Saturday morning. And Jake had gone out and bought a new suit. He came to me on the Friday morning. You can tell Jake this. And he said, I went up these digs last night, boss. He was doing nothing wrong, but his little girlfriend was there with him. And I said, what are you telling me, McLaughlin? He said, I said, look, we have rules and regulations. And that kid came into my office in his new suit, and I told him he would have been playing. I said, Jake, but you're not going, because you had to have rules. That boy and I got on very well. He respected me for it. He made the first team later on. He had a great career all round, and is a lovely, lovely boy. And I'd like you to pass on to Jake my kindest best luck and best regards.
I'll do that, Harry. He has nothing but kind words for you as well, incidentally. And he had many, many years at Shrewsbury. Went on to captain Cardiff.
Sean, you must tell the story, and Harry, I know Harry will enjoy it, and our listeners will enjoy it, because talk to us about the football, the ball being kicked out of the ground.
Well, Harry will remember this.
Because this is some story.
Shrewsbury Town, of course, is right next to the River Severn. The football ground is literally... a ball goes over the side of the main stand. It's called the Riverside Stand, which is a bit of a giveaway, and it goes into the River Severn. Now, for years and years and years, this is a very expensive habit if you lose balls in the river. So they had a little fella called Fred Davis.
Yes.
Who had a coracle. Yes. A unique type of boat. It's a round little boat which sits one man. And Fred Davis was famous throughout the world because when a ball went in the river, Fred would grab his coracle and rush out the back of the station stand and into the river. And he was renowned. He was, you know, he was the epitome of Shrewsbury. Yeah. Fred. Everybody knew Fred. And one day, Harry, you called on his services for another reason. Do you remember? You got him to run the line.
That is correct, because yeah. The linesman didn't turn up. And here's this fellow that rode this coracle, and he got a fiver for every ball he rescued.
That's right, yeah.
But I'll tell you a better one. This is incredible. This silly, big, thick Irish goalkeeper, a year after I was there, he said he was having terrible trouble rowing. And I said I'd get him an outboard motor. And I did. And 6 months later, he said he'd disappear. I think he flogged it.
Sean, how will Harry be remembered in Shrewsbury?
Well, Harry was there for all kinds of things, really. I mean, first of all, he came back from Scotland with his first game in charge. And he caught a bug in Scotland, so he was ill for the pre-season tour, weren't you?
That's correct.
And then you discovered Hormond Hill, didn't you?
I found the hill.
Hormond Hill is a big hill outside Shrewsbury. And Harry introduced a regime which is still loathed by Shrewsbury Town players 30 years later. Harry invented the Hormond Run, didn't you?
And Malcolm Starkey, can I ask you? Malcolm's still there.
Malcolm retires this year.
I took Malcolm, he was selling fridges, but he had a good career in football, and I brought Malcolm to the club, and I'm very proud that I did, because Malcolm went on to run the show.
Malcolm was, he was coach under you, was he?
Correct, he was.
And then he's become secretary of the club, and he's retiring this year. I think he's been there 42 years.
I talked him into it. He said, I can't do shorthand. I said, look, I sit in that boardroom and try to look intelligent, and I don't do shorthand, Malcolm. Take the job, the secretary never gets sacked. Jim Holton, remember him?
I do, yeah.
Sadly and tragically, Jim died at 42. Jim came to me in a free transfer and went on to join Manchester United.
Yeah, and you also got Joe Corrigan there.
Big Joe Corrigan, yes indeed. Kenny Mulhern, all those lads. Yeah,
Joe Corrigan now went on to play for England, of course, and Manchester City, but they lent him to Shrewsbury because they knew you'd coach him, didn't they?
Yeah. Sean, before I let you go, I suppose everyone in Man City is happy those times, aren't they?
Well,
for a lot of reasons.
It's a roller coaster ride at the moment. We don't know whether we're coming or going. We really don't know whether we're coming or going.
How is Shrewsbury Town doing?
Shrewsbury Town are doing very well.
Yeah, I noticed they're climbing up the table. If you don't be careful, you'll be promoted.
Yeah, I know. What would we do then? What would we do then?
Sean, listen to me. Give my regards to all.
I will, of course.
And thanks for joining us.
Take care. We send you, Harry.
Thank you, Sean. All the best.
Sean Fogarty from Shrewsbury. Bring back a few memories, Harry, about your... Listen, before we... How tough is management? We saw Gerard Hourier there lately. He got a bad knockout. Even though I saw his foot in the paper today, he's looking $1 million. How tough is management now?
It's tough, but the hard side of it is, to me, is the office side of it. You know, it's not something you grow up with a pair of boots on. You grow up with the excitement of playing. After that, the only thing that really matters is being involved on the playing side, going to players that are failed or down and telling them a fairy tale. And people talk about coaching. Coaching in any walk of life is a fairy tale. Lifting people when they're down and giving them a clip verbally around the ear hole to start to float. But me, I as a player wanted to hear people talk, tell me a fairy tale. Tell me about things that had happened in the past. And that's all I did in coaching. That's all I did in training. And I'm very proud that I think I had a better career after I finished as a coach.
Was this very stressful?
Ah, when you're losing, isn't it stressful?
Would you like to have had visions of I would say, being in charge of Man United? Or
Would you? Most definitely. Indeed, I would have done. Well, definitely. I'd have crawled my hands and knees.
While we're on it, before I forget it, we're flying through. Who's going to take over from Alex?
Who do I think?
Yeah. Who would you give it to? Alex Ferguson, when he goes.
I wouldn't say that I have the right to give it, but I'd say, back in my judgment, it could be another Irishman.
Who would you pick?
O'Leary. David O'Leary.
We'll go for him. Stay with us. Harry. We must turn now to something that I suppose you really don't like talking about too much and things like that, but we'll have to touch on it anyway. When you were coming home from the match against Belgrade on February the 6th, 1958, and you were after qualifying, gone through to the next round, and you got on the plane in Munich. I suppose, is it difficult to talk about? Are you tired of talking about it? You wouldn't talk about it until lately, isn't that right? Talk to us about that side of it.
I didn't really talk about it. To be frank, I didn't use it, as there are many that have, many that weren't there, until about the 40th anniversary, when I couldn't really get away from it because they had this game for us, which sadly, through no fault of Canton, has turned out to be the Canton farewell game, which was terribly wrong. I can't blame him for that. Now, I put that down to Martin Edwards. He used it for his own reasons, and yet he had nothing to do with it. But until then, I hadn't wanted to get involved in talking about it. I'd been there. I knew what happened. I listened to all the talk over 40 years over my head by people repeat that had not been there. To be honest with you, a lot of it made me sick. But eventually, at the game, I could, at the cathedral, well, they took us to a cathedral, the Manchester Cathedral, to have this service, and I had one of my daughters, Jane, with me, and I'm in, which is unbelievable, I'm in the pew second from the front. Sitting away to my right in another pew was Duncan Edwards' mother, and sitting about two pews behind me, I looked, and it was Marion Bent. And looking at the girl, she'd had a hard life, dressed in an old frock. And
Jeff Bent's wife.
I could have cried. And I watched Bobby Charlton get up and go over and talk to Duncan's mother and kiss her. And I thought, Christ, what about Marion Bent? And then just in front of me, in the pew in front of me, came four people. Two middle-aged people, a young man, a young girl. And this young fellow turned to me and said, could I shake your hand? I said, of course you can. And he said, I'm Roger Byrne. I didn't know what to do or to put myself in. I steered clear of that after the service in the cathedral. I didn't speak. I thought, Christ, that must be Joy. Remember, I'd stopped with Joy and Roger the week before the game. After we'd played Arsenal, I'd stopped at the weekend in their house. In fact, Roger's book came out recently, and it's a beautiful, beautiful book done by that lad, Alice, Ian
McCartney.
Aye.
From Loch Vale, Dumfries, sends you his best wishes. And he's the man you're talking about. A lovely letter I had from him during the week. And he said to make sure to send him your book when it comes out. I'm breaking your train of thought. Walk away, Harry.
He sent me the book, and I tell you, I did the foreword. I'm honoured that I did. But a lovely thing in it, the lovely thing about that book, there is one piece of bitterness from Joy Byrne or from the family. It's a lovely thing, the book. But I laugh when she tells about Harry Gregg, this great star, stopping with them, and they had a pup. And the pup took a liking to Harry Gregg. And the following morning, unbeknown to anyone, the pup must have got into my bedroom and wet the floor. And when I got out of bed, her and Roger, she tells in this book, which I think is lovely, watching, killing themselves, laughing, me down on my hands and knees on the floor, as I guess, thinking they might think it was me doing it, cleaning up the mess. But I stopped with it. I couldn't face those people. And eventually it came to the match. And how's this for rules and regulations? You're allowed to go yourself, and you 3 tickets for 3 of your family. Now, £1,000 was there, and they're in for nothing. I went about, and eventually, I said to my family, look, will you talk to Jackie Blanchflower? Jackie wasn't well at the time. I've got to go and see other people, other tables, people that I hadn't seen in 40 years, and make my way. I went outside, and the room's full of hangers on. And as I walk in the second time, Marion Bent is standing there with her daughter. And I said, what are you doing standing out here? And the daughter said, who's a grown woman? She was 4 months old at the time. My mummy doesn't think she's good enough to be in there. And I said, you get in there now. Got her in, marched her up the floor, marched her up the table where Molly Leach, Duncan's girlfriend, remember it well, Dennis Violet's first wife, also. I said, you know who this is? They looked. I said, you know who this is? And one of them said, God, it's Marion Bent. I said, of course it's Marion Bent. So and so and so and so. And one of the girls said to me, you're always that ignorant, Greg, aren't you? You're always the same. I said, no. She said, you don't know who I am. I said, I'll tell you who you are. And I told her who she was. But up to that time, I couldn't face it. And then eventually, my daughter spoke to Joy Byrne. And she spoke to me and she said, why have you been punishing yourself for 40 years? I said, Joy, I couldn't speak to you. I couldn't do it. There was nothing I could do. And it was the same with Mrs. Pegg. And it was the same with Mrs. Edwards. And Mrs. Edwards sadly said to my daughter, do you know, love, if my son had been sitting with your dad, he'd be here today. That's not true. But for years, I couldn't handle it. I just couldn't handle it. I got sick of the hypocrisy of the place. I got sick at times of Old Trafford as a player when I'm playing with so-called great players. And wishing fact is fact. And they're saying when they did some little thing, we won a cup or something. We did it for the lads at Munich. Cobblers. When a young Irish international fullback, a young Irish fullback, came to me one Friday and said, Harry, can I have a word with you? I said, what is it, Joe? And he said, some were private. So I said, let's go into the boot room. And he said to me, have they been to see you yet? And I said, what about some? He said, but putting some money in the game to lose. I said, you what? Wishy, you're looking straight across the table, I don't tell lies. You what? He said, what do I do? I said, they won't be bothering me, I'll tell you that. He said, what do I do? I said, well, there is honour among thieves, son. Go deaf, pretend you don't hear it. Don't bother me. About a fortnight later, I'm in the medical room with two highly regarded players, and they were both on the table, and I was waiting for my turn, and a jag here and a joke there and a few quid. And I said, that's the second time I've heard that. If I hear that again, I'm straight up the stairs and I'll tell him. And you won't have to ask who told, because it'll be me. Oh, you're mad. I said, that's okay, I'm mad. But don't let me hear it again.
We talked about throwing matches.
And I'm saying, and I hear people saying what we did for them. I couldn't put up with all that. So for 40 years I could. And I eventually did talk about it.
Harry, if I could bring you back, painfully though it is, to the runway in Munich that day, because all our generation, I remember where I was. I was playing snooker in the middle of the hall in Killarney, in the parish hall, and there was a small little radio up in the window above and top, and it was a cold, wet, dirt, that all day. And I remember the crackling radio and the news coming through in fits and bursts. And it's one of those things that everybody knows where they were when it happened. What was that? Liam Whelan had a premonition that it was going to happen. Our own Irish international.
The best way to do it is the night after the game. Some of the people went to the British Embassy. The rest went back to the car, back to the hotel, and played poker. And we played poker until 2 and 3 in the morning. And I had one of them good runs, and I skinned the school. But what I didn't know, every 10-shilling note I put in, the lads were putting in foreign money, which wasn't worth a shit, and taking out my 10-shilling note. But I cleaned the school out, and the following morning, we set off. It was snowing in Belgrade. Johnny Berry had lost his passport, so we were delayed by an hour on the aircraft after his passport. There was a six-seater table and a four-seater. The six-seater was Liam Whelan, Ray Wood, Johnny Berry, Roger Byrne, Jackie Blanchflower at the window, Ray Wood beside him, one empty seat, which was mine. And I said, you're not getting your money back. And I was in a wind-up. So from Belgrade to Munich, I sat and slept two seats from the front, and they kept giving me a dig. I said, you're not getting your money back. But I made up my mind when we get back on, after we had a meal in Munich, refueled, I would get back in my seat, make up the six, and give them a chance. So the plane came down. I was asleep, and they woke us up, fastened your safety belts. I looked out the window. It was snowing, and we hardly seen the ground till we were near it. It wasn't snowing heavily. We went in, bought a packet of cigarettes, Jackie Blanche flour, called back two or three minutes later, got on the aircraft, and she started off down the runway. Now, I'm still sitting strapped in a two-seater, two seats from the front, one set of seats with two press men behind me, and then the bulkhead. And as we started off down the runway the first time, I just looked out my window, watching the whales and watching the big telescopic rod expand. There was nothing untoward at all, apart from a little bit of, a fair bit of snow. And I just out of curiosity, I watched these expand. And then all of a sudden, I watched the wheels lock and unlock. And she started to spin. And I heard the thump from behind me on my right shoulder, and the poor steward, Tom Cable, threw himself out of the galley, or was thrown out, and threw himself into a three-seater beside a woman and child, and strapped himself in, and the poor fellow was terrified. That's the steward. He got the plane stopped, and they come on, and they said it was a technical hitch, we would go back and go again. And nobody was too perturbed. Off we went, back again to the beginning. I paid more attention out the window, and the bow wave of the snow was getting bigger. And we went on and on. We went places I hadn't been before, and I thought, we're up this time because the rod extended. And all of a sudden, thump again, wheels on, and she spun round on the runway. And they came on and said, apologised again, the same thing, but said, this time we will go back to the terminal and you will disembark. So we headed back to the terminal, got off the plane. And when I say now, wishing we were not in there, I couldn't say 2 minutes or I couldn't say five. We weren't in 5 minutes when the call was United Party back on board again. And she was a backside loader. And as I got on, I live with this and feel so sorry for that fellow. As I got on the aircraft on the third attempt and turned in the door, who was strapped in the back seat? Tom Cable, the poor steward. And I thought to myself, Christ, he's worried man, he's frightened. Poor fellow, he should be attending to you. Made my way to the front of the aircraft. Bobby Charlton and David Pegg, who had been acting the clown on a three-seater opposite me, they said they were going to the back. I settled myself in. Billy Foulkes was in front of me, and Billy wouldn't be as tall as I was, and I could see the top of his seat, head over the seat. And there was a big metal thing with a bolt the plane together. And in my stupid way, I thought, all I thought, if this thing belly flaps, he'll jam his brains in. So what I did was open my tie, pull down my tie, open the front of my trousers, and get down low on my seat so the head of the seat would be above my head. That's the only thing I did. We started to roll, and someone said, there was a head count, we're one short. They stopped the plane. Alf Clark from the Manchester Evening News had stopped to phone his wife. Well, he got on the aircraft, and big Frank Swift and two or three more shouting, scoop, scoop, Clark. Got settled down. Now, the only person across from me was Frank Taylor. And I diagonally was the six-seater table with the empty seat. Liam Whelan was sitting in the aisle seat. And we started off, and this time I was reading a book. To this day, I can remember the book. It was called The Whip by Roger MacDonald. And it was one of those early days pornography. And I thought to myself, Henry Rose had come and had gone all around the plane, been passed around everybody. I was last to get it. Henry Rose came to me and said, when you finish with that book, I've got to get it. Well, I thought, because I was hellfire and damnation in those days, good living. You could convince people today. And I thought, Christ, if I get killed reading this book, I'll go to hell. So I put the book away. I did. I honestly, I tried to put the book away. I thought, if I get killed here reading that thing, I'll go to hell. We sat up down the runway again. I watched the rods all the time, and I watched them, and Johnny Berry coughed. I looked across diagonally at Roger Byrne, and where I was a bit worried, when I looked at Roger, I laughed. His face was contorted. I thought, somebody here more frightened than I am. And somebody laughed, and little Johnny Berry said he was sitting between Liam Whelan and Roger Byrne, and across from them, Ray Wood and Jackie Blanchler. And he said, I know what you're all freaking laughing at here. We're all going to get killed. And Liam Whelan sitting in the aisle seat said, well, if it happens, I'm ready. That's just, I mean, no one could invent it. I watched the wheels lift, and the next thing, I got hit up the barrier. You get hit all the way, you don't know what's going on. It's daylight, it's darkness, it sparks, and something hit the back of my head. I felt something got my nose, I felt blood and blackness and so forth. And all of a sudden, there was no screaming, it was just tearing the metal from daylight to darkness. So I can't, I think I'm dead. Just lay there. And then I saw a shaft of light off to my right, way above me. I thought, Christ, I'm not dead. I was afraid to touch the top of my head because I thought it would come off like a hard-boiled egg. And I reached down to unfasten my safety belt and didn't realise that I didn't have a belt. Didn't realise anything. But I couldn't relate to the darkness where it was daylight. I started to crawl to the shaft of light and I put my head out through the hole in the top of the aircraft and I looked down below and I seen the first dead man I'd seen. And it was Bert Wally, the youth team coach, and he was lying below me about 6 or 7 feet down. There wasn't a mark on him, wearing the previous cup finals grey suit. And I couldn't get out the hole, so I turned around my backside and kicked the hole a bit bigger, and I dropped out, and just a terrible hiss and a burn where there'd been an engine before. There was no wing. And I stood there for a second or two, and there was five people running away in the distance. The two stewardesses, a fellow called Rogers, a radio operator, for want of a better word, and Peter Hard and Ted Elliard, two journalists, and they shouted, run, it's going to explode, run, it's going to explode. And just with that came brave man, Jim Thane, the pilot who lived. He came around what was left of the cockpit, and he shouted, run, you stupid bastard, it's going to explode. And he had a little fire extinguisher in his hand. And then he turned around and ran back the way he'd come. And I heard a child crying, and I heard movement, and they were shouting, run, and I shouted, come back here. There's people alive in here. And I just kept going, and I lost my temper, and I shouted, come back, you bastards, there's people alive in here. Anyway, I made my way in over the top of what had come out of, and I knew it had come out of cross bodies in the darkness. And eventually, I was terrified, Wishy, of what I would find. Terrified. I found the romper suit belonging to this child, trying to trace the noise, but there was nothing in it, and I was relieved. And then eventually I found the baby, and I crawled out, it cut around its eyes and things, and I ran after these people and shouted, take it off me. And Rogers, the operator, came back and took it off me and took off with it. And I went back again, and eventually I didn't find the mother found me. It just exploded in the darkness, and she would be my age, actually, around my age at the time. And I couldn't describe it. Her face was completely flat. She had no features. And it was black, as cold black as a fireplace, back of a fireplace. I got her to the hole, and I didn't take her out. I put my feet in the middle of her back and just kicked her through the hole, and she kept going. I then went, and I tried to get Ray Wood out, and I couldn't get him out. And he was trapped. I then found Albert Scanlon, and Albert made me sick. Albert was... his head was completely and totally cracked. Cracked like a hard-boiled egg in two places. He's talking about it now. Yeah, it's not. Blood came out of his ears and everything. And I couldn't get him out. I come out of the aircraft. There's nobody there. I climbed over what was left of a stump of a wing. And as I climbed over that, I found Charlton and Dennis Fyle lying half in and half out of what was left of the front of the aircraft. There was nothing left of the aircraft. And I would say now, a terrible lot of people didn't come home. I never thought we're living or dead. I just grabbed them by the waistband of their trousers and pulled them away through the snow. Dennis felt a terrible cut in the back of his head. And that's when I discovered how bad it was. I got round what was left of the aircraft, and there was a house with a quarter of the roof off it burning, and there was a petrol dump 50, 60 yards away with the rest of the plane and the fuel dump. It came off like a bomb. I made my way and I found the boss lying, as he's saying, iron on his kitty hunkers. And he's lying on the snow, propped up on his elbow, and he was moaning about his chest. And funny, he had an operation about 2 weeks before for veins in his legs, before he went. And I thought, he's talking about his chest. But compared with what I had seen before I got to the boss, he wasn't bad. He had a wee cut behind his, little cut behind his right ear. Till I looked down, his foot was completely reversed the other way, but there was no blood there. And I propped him up with some rubbish, and just said, you're okay, boss, because to me he looked okay compared to others. I left him, and I'd started shouting, Blanche, Blanche, whether it's from childhood, Jackie Blanchflower, and eventually I found Jackie. He was lying over near where the plane was burning, the rest of the plane, and he was crying, and the heat was melting the snow, and he didn't realize, he tells me afterwards he did, Roger Byrne was lying across him, and he was crying, he was paralyzed, he broke his back, and you know, you rabbit away, and I got down, and when I looked, Jackie's right arm was hanging off, and he hadn't even noticed it. Just make your usual noise, you're all right. And I took my tie off and tied it around the stump of his arm. He didn't even notice, and he's crying that he broke his back. Roger, not a mark on him, not a single solitary mark. And Jack, it turns out, was lying watching the second hand, his watch all the time he lay there. Broke my tie, and first time started to scrabble around, the first time I looked, lifted my head, and one of the poor Stuart S's was looking down at me. And I said, for Christ's sake, get me something to tie his arm, which he was gone in shock. And then a van turned up, a blue Volkswagen van with a side door and a back door. A fellow turned up with a hypodermic syringe, but every time, and a black bag and a tweed coat, every time this thing exploded, he took and run. Till eventually he slipped his arms with a hypodermic syringe up in the air. Ordinary people came from across the fields from a village and helped get the bodies and people into vans and get them off the hospital. That includes me. And there was no firefighters. And there was no fire engines, and there was no nothing. So all that, the efficiency of the German people, good luck to them, and these firefighters coming down the runway after the plane, I never saw any of them. There was nobody there. Anyway, we went to... The biggest shock I got was Dennis Phelan and Bobby Charlton. They were working with somebody else, and they turned around, and they were looking down at me. Well, I'd left them for... They're gone. They got us off the hospital in this old coal van, and... Bobby Charlton was walking around with Bill Foulkes, myself, a big Yugoslav, Peter Hard, and Ted Elliard. And they asked some of us to go and identify some of the people while they were operating on them. After we'd done that, some nuns took us down and gave us soup. And then we were taken to a medical room and they started to give us injections. And they gave Foulkes an injection, Bill Foulkes an injection, and they put them on the table. And... They put me at a table and give me an injection. They gave Bobby Charlton an injection and he fainted and they carried him away. And I said, I'm not staying in here. I am not staying in here. And I insisted I wasn't staying in the hospital. And they took us to the Stahus Hotel, where the manager was exceptionally good to us and for the best part of the day kept the press away. So that's Munich as I've seen it.
Well, that was really a harrowing description, a vivid account of the Manchester United air disaster. Very, very vivid. We were listening to there for the last 20 minutes or so. And changing the subject, Harry, we'd be looking forward to going to the town hall after you getting a civic reception from the Truly Urban District Council. And after that, you're going to Kirby's and there are going to be a lot of the supporters' clubs meeting you. But we are going to the comment line now because we are going to want to talk to one of our top Irish sports writers and sports analysts, well known on Irish TV, I can tell you. He has played professional soccer in England for 17 years, five of them with Manchester United. And he brought out a book there a few years ago. I found it an absolutely fascinating book on Matt Busby. It was called A Strange Kind of Glory. Fascinating book. He's joining us in the line. He knows your career. He knows more about Man United. He's Eamon Dunphy. Eamon, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good evening, Richie. How are you?
Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
Now, Eamon, how will Harry Gregg be remembered? What are your memories and your thoughts on him? He's here with us.
Well, Harry will be... Good evening, Harry.
Good evening, Eamon.
Harry will be remembered as a very, very courageous man who risked his life to save his friends in the Munich air disaster. And there's no sort of higher calling. There's no demand ever made on a person like that in normal life. And Harry will be remembered as someone who met that call when it was demanded of him. And he will be remembered also as a great goalkeeper. And as a member of a very great side and one of the greatest sides in the history of the game, and he'll also be remembered as a great character, and part of the reason why everyone wants to follow Manchester United now and watch Manchester United and worship the contemporary game is men like Harry Gregg. without them, there wouldn't have been the glory and the great story that there is for people to identify with.
So, Eamon, if I could...
He's an immense man in the game.
If I could put it to you like this way now, how would Harry do if he was playing instead of Baptiste today? Can I put it to you like that?
I never saw Harry make mistakes remotely like the mistakes Barthez has made in recent weeks, although Harry was, like most goalkeepers, a bit crazy. But he was a he was a bit crazy, as crazy as any Protestant, black Protestant gets.
You said in your book, A Strange Kind of Glory, that he was prone to wander for the field.
The first goalkeeper who ever reinvented the role, or one of the first, I mean, he reinvented a role like all the greats. I mean, he made something of his own of goalkeeping and had very strong opinions about the game, a very deep knowledge of the game, and he wasn't a goalkeeper who stayed on his line. He was probably the first goalkeeper in the history of the game to see his responsibility for being a fifth defender, as it were. And that was the right thing to do. So, like all originals, and Harry is very much an original, there's no other Harry Gregg. There's only one. And like all originals, he left a deep imprint on the game and all the people of that.
Yeah, I mean, would I be right or wrong in saying, and correct me here if I am, and I know everybody will, that he's one of these people who's a legend in his own lifetime.
He is, yeah. He's an original legend for his kind of... He was a great... He was much loved. He was a great man for fun. And he was, you know, he was a kind of... I mean, the ultimate thing about Harry is what he did without any prompting or any script in Munich. And that's the ultimate testimony to his courage and to his character. And nobody could pay a better tribute to him than that, and it's true, we know it's true. And others, you know, wouldn't have found it within them. But he was also a fun man, and he also gave me a few kiffs around the ear. When I published that book, and he phoned up to tell me that I was a complete wimp and a coward and a dad.
No, and you said to me, screw me, you bastard. And I said, what did I say, man? I don't do those things. I remember Dumpf. I've said it, and I say it quite, as you know I will do, Dumpf always was, even as a kid, had a very, very, very brilliant mind. And if he was on your side, you're a lucky man, but if he wasn't, he had a pen full of vitriol. Eamon, I would say to you, in all honesty, you know I don't patronise.
No, I know you don't do that, Harry.
Neither does Dumpy, that's why we agree. That fellow you talked about recently, and you keep laughing, I keep watching you and Gilesy, and I keep thinking, are those two still talking, or are they kidding themselves sitting out there?
And Eamon, answer that question. That's a good question.
John is a great man. If you, I mean, you like John, Harry.
Great friends.
We're great friends.
Great time.
Eamon, we'll be looking forward to Harry's biography when it comes out. We'll be coming out.
You'll have to get a legion of libel lawyers.
Eamon, I bought a desert island because I know when mine comes out, I'm going to have to get... Listen, Dunk, being serious now for a minute.
This is lovely to talk to you, Harry.
Honest to God. And we've argued. Do you remember a kid one day and a five's head up the back in the concrete?
George Best.
No, a fella called Dumpy. He's the first one that ever happened to me. And he gave me a bit of lip and it was a kicking match. You're only a kid.
Anyway, you picked me up and...
No. And I said, yeah, you pup. And you stopped and you pointed your finger and said, I'm going to see a solicitor, so I hit you again. Dump, it's great talking.
Eamon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Harry, I tried to invent human rights.
Eamon, thanks for joining us.
And look after Harry.
And listen, we'll have to get you down next year to Radio Kerry.
The best place in the world, Harry. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eamon.
Eamon
Dunphy there, always a nice man to talk to, and always speaks his mind. We're going for a quick break. You met the great Martin Bracker Regan today, the great former Kerry footballer, and you also met the retired butcher from Kinmare, the best United man in Kerry, Tony Murphy.
I met both. My pleasure. The little man of 92 is incredible. And when I took his hand, I thought his hand was stronger than mine was.
That's Bracker now, not Tony.
Oh, no, it's not Tony, no.
Tony Murphy.
Tony
Murphy
finished my life 34 years ago, but we won't talk about that.
One of the great Manchester United supporters in Kerry, incredible. Tony Murphy. We'll be meeting him. Very quick, what do you think of this Irish team I picked? The best Irish team from Old Trafford. Harry Gregg in goal. I have your own goal. Harry Gregg in goal. Jimmy Nicol, Dennis Irwin, Kevin Moore, Paul McGrath, Tony Dunn. Sammy McIlroy, Roy Keane, the captain. Georgie Best, Frank Stapleton, Norman Whiteside. How would that do?
I'll let you pass because I'm a nice easygoing fella.
would you agree with it? Would you add anyone on to it?
Yeah, I might do.
Come here. The routine of training. How are you to train, Harry? Well, you're a good man to train. And injuries. You got a bad injury, finish your grief. Talk to us about that.
I had a lot of injuries from broken arms, legs, lungs, ribs, shoulders, you get on with it, because in those days, I mean, do you lie down and die, or do you pick yourself up and get on with it? The great thing about training, I think, pointed out around the time of the accident, rather than say disaster, if I had to come home and sit around the house all day, I think I would have gone stark raving mad. I had to go down to Old Trafford and do the same thing, train and argue and play and fight and kick. I think it saved my sanity.
Harry, 13 days after the Munich air crash, I must say this to you, you played Sheffield Wednesday, beaten 3-0 in the Cup. There was a programme printed. Was the United team on the programme?
There was no team on the programme at all.
No team on the programme.
And some of the fellas I played with that night I'd never met before. There was no, but there was a big crowd and the club would go on. Yeah. Again, sentiment overruled everything.
Harry, any regrets in life?
Very, very, very few. No regrets in my sporting life, apart from the fact that I had one or two injuries. Let me say this. If I had been born a rich man, I would have paid to have the pleasure of doing what I was paid for.
Does the Manchester United Munich air disaster, does it haunt you?
No.
Is it gone from your life? In that respect, you don't wake up in the middle of the night?
Do you sit down
at home in the quietness of your home and listen and think about it?
I tell you when I think about it, I go out occasionally for a walk or a run.
Harry Gregg, listen to me, I'm interrupting you here. You have a special piece of music, Denny Boy, I know that. And I know you sang that all over the world. I've heard that, especially with the music. Come here, listen to me. It was a pleasure having you and Kerry and your wife, Caroline.
Thank you.
It was one of my dreams after I seen you from the Stretford Inn in Old Trafford in 1957. I never thought I'd meet you. Never thought I'd meet you. But you have bridged a huge gap by coming to Kerry. Your Manchester United are an institution down here. Even though we've nothing against the rest of the clubs either. I'd put you like that. So, Harry, it was lovely having you.
And it was beautiful and it was wonderful to be invited. I'm a very, very, very proud man.
Harry Gregg, you're an officer and a gentleman and a good judge of whiskey. Thanks for being on Terrorstock.
Wonderful to be here with you. Thank you, and to all the people in Kerry that wish me a welcome. Thank you very much indeed.